Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Ragini Singh Pawar. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at beyond_headlines. That's BYOND_headlines. The Belt and Road Initiative, launched in 2013 by President Xi Jinping, is China's ambitious project to finance and build infrastructure globally. The third Belt and Road Forum was held in Beijing in October and marked a significant milestone, celebrating 10 years of BRI. This week's episode dives into the Belt and Road Initiative's evolution over the last 10 years, where we take a closer look at BRI as a tool of China's foreign policy, its impacts in the global south, and its ongoing recalibration. In the first segment, Dr. Chongjia Ian provides insights on BRI's strategic significance for China and its far-reaching implications in South and Southeast Asia. The second segment highlights the BRI's impact in Africa, where Dr. Isaac Odum speaks on the BRI's role in bridging the infrastructure gap in African nations, along with its debt sustainability problem. Our first guest today is Dr. Chongjia Ian. Dr. Chong is an Associate Professor of Political Science at the National University of Singapore and a non-resident scholar at Carnegie, China. Dr. Chong's research interests include U.S.-China relations and Chinese foreign policy. He is the author of the book External Intervention in the Politics of State Formation, China, Indonesia, Thailand, and has received the 2013 International Security Studies Section Book Award from the International Studies Association. He has also been published in outlets such as China Quarterly and Pacific Affairs, and is the editor of Academia SG, which seeks to promote Singapore-related research.
Welcome, Dr. Chong. Thank you so much for joining me today on Beyond the Headlines. So to start off our conversation, could you please provide our listeners with a brief overview of the Belt and Road Initiative and how it came to be in 2013?
So the Belt and Road Initiative is, in essence, an effort by the PRC to engage in infrastructure building and development in less developed parts of the world, notably in Central Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, parts of the Middle East, and also Africa and Latin America. Part of the rationale behind this is that at that point in time, the PRC felt that it had excess capital. It had a lot of developmental experience. So by investing overseas in places that needed infrastructure, what it would do was to address some of its excess capital, put the capital to better use, while aiding with development and also being able to get a foot in terms of having closer ties with various states along areas that are important for the PRC, either because they are sources of key minerals or because they lie along important transportation routes that the PRC uses to do its import and export, and importantly, its import of energy.
So now the BRI has involved projects in a wide variety of sectors, ranging from shipping to energy, infrastructure, and even manufacturing. So to what extent did national security play a part in the choice of sectors? And do you think that this security consideration has evolved since the BRI came into being?
So there's always, I think, been some security consideration in the BRI. So if you look at a lot of the discussion in the PRC in the lead up to the BRI, there was, for instance, some talk about a so-called Malacca Strait dilemma, which meant to say that the PRC was very dependent on the Malacca Strait for energy imports, for importing and exporting the goods that it produced. So what that meant is that it needed the Malacca Strait, but also it would be subject to any closure or blockage by any unforeseen incidents or perhaps hostile action. So in order to mitigate those risks, one of the directions in which the policy discussion was going was to find alternative routes to diversify risk, so to speak. So this Belt and Road project is one way that provides alternative routes for trade, for energy imports to the PRC. So there's that consideration. But the BRI over time has also morphed such that many things get tied into the BRI. So a lot of the more economic considerations, sometimes BRI projects seem to be driven by powerful interests in the state-owned enterprise sector. Given the size of the BRI project and how diverse it is, it's also expected that you have many more different kinds of interests come in addition to the sort of strategic security considerations that probably was important at the outset.
And building on that, how has China utilized the BRI as a tool of its foreign policy? And what has it achieved in advancing its interests abroad?
So what the PRC has done, I think consciously, been a few things. One is that it has tried to put itself across as a partner of choice for states that are perhaps more in need of development, who would prefer to get loans and development assistance in ways that are not subject to the standard due diligence practices and norms that aid agencies in more developed countries like to put forward. So that has, I think, helped the PRC gain some traction in some quarters. I think the promise of big development, you know, especially infrastructure development and the associated economic growth, that has made the PRC seem very attractive. It has made some states, I think, quite willing to appeal to the PRC. And certainly all this fits within the PRC sort of older mode of putting itself as a champion of the developing world. So that's the more direct kinds of, I suppose, intended foreign policy kinds of outcomes. There are others as well, which may be less intended. So, for instance, what has happened is with a lot of the big projects, the ways that the debt had been raised created situations where some countries were overly optimistic and ended up not being able to pay back, and that led to seizures, which of assets that proved domestically quite tumultuous. Sri Lanka is an example of this. Pakistan. So that has made the PRC, I think, a subject of controversy that it didn't expect. There's a talk about this debt trap diplomacy. I'm less convinced by that argument. What seems to me to be more like the case is that the PRC and its local partners went in being overly optimistic and really underestimated the rent-seeking behavior that would come about, and then the need to sort of claw back the losses. So remember I talked about how the PRC approached its BRI development plans with less stringent due diligence measures. So that would get you in the door very quickly. But there's a reason why developed aid organizations and states that have very mature aid mechanisms have due diligence. It's precisely to avoid these sorts of problems. And in some respects, I suppose the PRC and its push was like many great powers before it. It had an overinflated sense of its own importance and exceptionalism, thinking that problems that applied to everyone else wouldn't apply to themselves. The US was like that, the Soviets were like that, British, the French, all like that. So they all claim that they're exceptionally good or virtuous, but they end up doing much the same thing. So I suppose the PRC fell into that trap, like many other great powers. Now, there's the other bit, which is also tied to the due diligence, which is when you are involved in infrastructure projects, you, especially big ones, you take away someone's land, you affect the ecosystem somewhere. And so that leads to social displacement, and sometimes that creates political backlash. So in that respect, along some parts of the Belt and Road, PRC has, not by intention, but I think just by the fact of what they're doing, has created some significant amount of friction between themselves and local authorities, whether in government or elsewhere. I think the other bit about the PRC's foreign policy is, I think if we take a step back and talk about how some of the operationalization works, big infrastructure projects are inherently risky. Returns are almost inherently slow to come. And so they take a long time to sort of recover all the costs. So when states are both on PRC side and also the local partners are over-optimistic, this creates a situation where, you know, paying back is a problem. And I mean, if you think about the BRI, it's a very ambitious project. The reason why there's a lack of investment in many of these places that the PRC decided to go into isn't necessarily because these places were particularly problematic. It's just that the commercial case for investing in these places was a lot more difficult. So given the returns, given the risks, commercial companies don't want to go in. Other aid agencies that are doing their due diligence figure that, okay, given our limited aid monies, perhaps investing in some other place would be more worth it, perhaps would be safer. But the PRC took this very bold move into going into these areas. Sure, the infrastructure and all that was demanded, but it's very high risk. So it's gotten all the sort of pushback. I think what it's done, that process has done, is gotten people to also look again at the PRC. I mentioned how the PRC is not different from other great powers, other big powers. Before that, there was sometimes a view that Beijing could do no wrong, had this sort of long-term plan, that it had some secret to doing the development. But as it turns out, it doesn't. It's like everybody else. It's trying to figure its way through. It's just that the scale makes everything so much more obvious. And I suppose that gives other states a little bit of pause when they deal with Beijing, a little bit more caution. So that's on the one end. The last bit I add on PRC foreign policy is for states where the PRC does have a big presence or others that are seeking it, the view that Beijing could politicize some of its investment, pull back, so on and so forth, has created a certain degree of trepidation, in particular when it comes to doing things and saying things that people anticipate or governments anticipate might cross Beijing the wrong way. So that's led to a certain degree of perhaps self-censorship in terms of foreign policy as well. So yeah, it's a whole chunk of things, but I think that comes with the fact that the BRI is this massive project that touches on so many different areas.
So you have touched on this a little bit already, and you've spoken about Sri Lanka and Pakistan. Could you speak a bit more about the status of BRI projects in South or Southeast Asia, and what has the impact been in the region?
I'll talk first about Southeast Asia, the area where I know a little bit better. So the impact has been very mixed. So you do get BRI projects up and running, the high-speed rail in Laos, the high-speed rail in Indonesia that was just opened, and now there's talk about financing for another high-speed rail line in Indonesia. So these have been the relatively more successful projects that have actually come to fruition. However, there is still the question of debt. There is still the question of when they were being built, of displacement. One of the reasons why these projects took so long is because if you think about any rail line, you're taking away land from somebody. There needs to be some sort of compensation process. And if that's not done well, there's a lot of resistance. Within the PRC, the state can clamp down quite quickly, and that doesn't become so much of a problem. In other places where state capacity is a bit weaker, or in the Indonesia, where it's actually a democracy, it has to respect to some degree the will of the population. It can't move as quickly against people who have these claims against the state. So those are some of the relatively more successful projects. There's some sort of in the mixed area, like in Cambodia, where PRC monies associated with the BRI help with port building, has helped with urban development. But that has also brought up housing prices quite a bit. That's put pressure on the local population. It has been associated, because of this lack of due diligence, right? Associated with corruption. It's been associated with also crime. So there is that sort of darker side to the BRI in Cambodia, even though it, I think, has really helped spur Cambodia's economic growth. Then you have places like Thailand, where the BRI project, again, the high-speed rail, they have stalled in part because of land acquisition, in part because of interest, so that there things haven't been going that smoothly. When you look at the cases of Malaysia and the Philippines, there things got quite caught up with domestic politics, in the sense that with the Malaysian case, a previous government had taken a lot of these loans from the PRC to cover up the hole in their finances created by massive fraud. And so those projects had to be put on ice. There's talk about restarting it, but I think some of the earlier promises, the scale is a bit difficult to digest. In the Philippines, you have a case where there were many promises that were made, many of which only partially or did not materialize. So that, I think, created a large degree of disappointment. Then there's this, I guess, the special case of Myanmar, where PRC was previously trying to work with the National League for Democracy government. When that fell because of the coup, the PRC quite quickly tried to work its way with all parties, but notably improve its relations with the military, which had previously been a little bit rockier. That's in part because there's a port and a pipeline running through Myanmar that is one of these ways that the PRC diversifies its import of energy that I talked about. So it wants to protect its equities there. So that's the Southeast Asia picture, which is very mixed. In the South Asia picture, India has been far more cautious, in part because they see themselves in more of a rivalry with the PRC. So there was some talk about BRI, but I don't think that India was that enthusiastic. Sri Lanka had historically been successive governments that have been quite friendly with the PRC. The PRC was very helpful in providing arms to help it fight the Tamil Tigers. So they looked to the PRC as a source of development. But of course, I think there was a case where there was too much optimism in terms of what the port building and all that could do, and the airport building could deliver, especially once COVID hit. They didn't get the numbers that they expected. So Debt became a serious problem. Debt interest became a serious problem. They had to talk with the IMF. They had to talk to the PRC about debt restructuring. And of course, that whole process hit the Sri Lankan economy and politics very hard, right? Led to a fall of government and all that. And in the Pakistan case, Pakistan, again, a state that has historically, for decades, very close relations with Beijing, a place that Beijing calls an all-weather friend. So with Gwadar, with the economic corridor, there was a lot of enthusiasm for it. But like with all other kinds of investments of this sort, they are expensive, the return is low. And when you're building through people's land or in places that are highly contested, PRC projects, like projects elsewhere, done by other governments, become targets for attack. The PRC, I guess, because of their comfort with Pakistan, thought it wouldn't happen. But they've, I suppose, encountered the fate of many other major powers when they try to go into some other area that they don't control. So that in the Pakistani case, that, of course, has also led to Pakistan's fiscal problems that has contributed to its political instability. I mean, there was political instability for other reasons, but the way that the debt and all that worked out wasn't helpful in stabilizing successive governments in Pakistan.
So switching gears a little bit and coming to more recent events, how has Russia's invasion of Ukraine impacted the BRI project in Central and Eastern Europe?
So that's a really great question, because here's one of those things that with these big projects, there are these externalities that you don't expect. And what happened with Russia is the PRC over the years has decided that it wanted to have a closer relationship with Moscow, notably underscored by the meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping right before the last Winter Olympics, where there was the proclamation that the two sides had a friendship without limits. And then we had the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And because of the PRC relationship with Russia and the unwillingness to put, you know, significant pressure on Russia to stop its aggression, what we saw was a lot more apprehension in Europe toward the PRC as an extension of the wariness toward Russia. And really, I mean, if you look at Eastern and Central Europe, these are places that had been under Russian or Soviet domination for decades during the Cold War. So they already are quite cautious about Russia. And when you have the Russians and the PRC seem to be tightly associated, all the sort of fears start coming out. I mean, before, Central and Eastern Europe did look to the PRC as a means to get more capital and as a means to help with their development. But all that really changed with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yeah, there's a lot more caution. Things have slowed down. Notably, places like Czechia and Lithuania have started looking elsewhere. They've looked toward working more closely with Taiwan in terms of technology. That's gotten blowback, of course, from Beijing, but they've decided that they wanted to weather it. And if you move slightly west and south, you get Italy, which assessed its Belt and Road projects. It was one of the Western European states that was very eager to jump on. And it figured that it really wasn't getting that much out of it, which is understandable, because the Belt and Road project is meant to put in infrastructure in places that lack them. Italy doesn't lack infrastructure in the way that, say, Myanmar or Bangladesh. So Italy has decided to withdraw. And that also interacts with the fact that the Russian invasion of Ukraine just makes Western Europeans also very suspicious of PRC that is unwilling to condemn Russian actions.
Now, as you've mentioned before, the Belt and Road Initiative is such a massive project globally. How is the success of such a large project even evaluated? And in your opinion, in the eyes of China, has there been any success in the BRI in the last decade?
Right. So I think there has been some degree of success. Like I said, in Southeast Asia, it's got some projects through. It's built up some closer ties. It's created a atmosphere where I think governments are afraid of crossing the PRC, so they become more pliant to PRC demands. I think you can see a similar kind of dynamic in Central Asia, where I think arguably the BRI has been more successful in terms of getting the railway through Central Asia to Europe, in terms of getting oil and gas from Central Asia to the PRC. So that has been relatively successful. Those projects seem to be relatively less contested. So with these big projects, it's always a mixed picture. There will be successes. There will be failures. But this is the thing with risky projects. The successes, will be steady and solid, but often not spectacular, whereas the failures will tend to be very much pronounced. So everyone sees what happened in Sri Lanka, for instance, and remembers that. So this is not something that is unique to the PRC. It's a nature of these sorts of projects. I mean, if you think about the various efforts by the Soviets and the Americans to build infrastructure, to push development in various parts of the world during the Cold War, there were some successes, some quite notable. I mean, look at Western Europe or Japan, and South Korea and Taiwan, sure. But there were also some pretty big failures, South Vietnam being one, on the Soviet side, Afghanistan, and of course their efforts in Central and Eastern Europe. So these big mega projects, they can work, but success tends to be more spotty and accrue over time. So I think if you want to consider some of the more successful projects, if you ask yourself, what is the BRI a case of, like, these mega infrastructure development projects? So you might consider the Transcontinental Railroad in Canada and the United States. You know, big projects, big things when they were done, but the success has really been accrued over decades. The Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, the Trans-Siberian Railroad, these are things that are there and are important. But today, you know, they don't spark the same sort of excitement when they were rolled out, because that's the nature of these things. They are useful and they accrue benefits over time.
So you've spoken about the problems of debt in BRI countries. And in the current context, we see increasing tensions between the United States and China, and also a domestic economic slowdown in China. So how do you see the BRI evolving in light of these issues in the coming years?
So in some degree, we know how the BRI is going to evolve. During the last Belt and Road Forum, Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, has said this: he wants a BRI that focuses more on sort of green energy. He's looking at, you know, digital infrastructure rather than, you know, these big hard physical. These are important, but they're not the same scale. And Xi Jinping, during the Belt and Road Forum, has remarked, also talked about how he's looking to shift the BRI to what he calls small and beautiful projects rather than these sort of huge mega projects. So that's a reflection. I mean, it's all couched in very nice language, but I think it's a reflection of the fact that you can only have so much infrastructure before you reach diminishing, not even diminishing marginal returns, but diminishing returns. You can only have so many rail lines. You can only have so many ports if demand isn't growing as fast. So there has to be a recalibration. I think there's also recognition that there is risk for China as well. When you put money in, we talk about the debt of debtor countries. We talk about debtor countries and what they owe and how this is destabilizing for them. But for the PRC, it's also a chunk of money that they've committed somewhere that they may not be able to get back in a short period of time, or may not be able to get back at all. And at a time when there is more of a domestic slowdown, there's less money to throw around. So on the PRC side, I think they've realized that they need to be more prudent as well. And I suppose part of that greater prudence and having more efficient, smaller projects, greener projects, is also a reflection of learning from the PRC's own domestic experience. So one of the real pushes for the BRI initially was that, well, hey, look at China. We've done all this development. It's worked really well. We've grown really fast. We've weathered the global financial crisis, and so we can bring our experience to other locations. As it turns out, the PRC isn't as exceptional. If you look at China domestic, talk about domestic debt, a lot of this domestic debt and slowdown is from infrastructure building, because to keep the economy going, the PRC essentially, central government told local governments that they had to go build stuff and build infrastructure and essentially pump prime the economy. That led to steady growth for a while, but again, it's come to a point where, you know, returns are declining. And in the PRC, they have the coercive tools of state to make sure the blowback is more under control. Now, you can suppress some of the blowback for a while, but then the economic reality will start biting, right? So that's happened domestically. And what we're seeing externally is really, I suppose, a similar kind of process, just with less ability to use coercive state tools to keep down the resistance, the opposition. So I think given the domestic and the external learning, the PRC is figuring that they probably need to adjust the BRI to something that is more digestible both for themselves and also for the host countries. So that's where we're going. And of course, a lot of the official discussion about the BRI will be how successful and wonderful it is, because it cannot be the case for the CCP that the model that their leader had pushed out is, you know, turns out to be less spectacular than initially advertised. Although in states, you know, where there is more open discourse, this is par for the course, right? But so the point here is that you have to look at the rhetoric and how the degree to which that diverges or converges with the reality on the ground in a more carefully, in a way that perhaps you know, you don't have to, because things are more apparent with big projects in states like Canada, the US, or Europe.
And so you just spoke about the third Belt and Road Forum, which concluded in Beijing on October 18th. So just to round up our conversation, could you provide some key takeaways or announcements that were made during the forum?
So I think the key takeaways, I just sort of touched on them, the focus on green sustainability, the calibration away from the big to the small and beautiful, which is no less important, because if you are getting into digital infrastructure, the servers, the cables, the routers, you know, that's really how economies will be run more and more. That's how we're having this meeting. That's how other business meetings take place. That's how contracts, plans, blueprints get sent and worked on, documents as well. So as the PRC gets into that, I mean, it is certainly a growth area. It's a much smarter approach, I think, than the previously sort of broad brushstroke look at that development. So, I mean, that's very much, I think, with the content of the Third Belt and Road Forum and the push by Xi Jinping there. I think the other thing that's useful to note about the Third Belt and Road Forum is that the participation was a bit different. Sure, Putin was there and he made use of the Belt and Road Forum to do a lot of his international diplomacy that he was unable to conduct because of the limitations and sanctions on by many countries. So he got to meet many top officials, heads of state. But also, it was much smaller in scale. Some of the representation was at a lower level. So before, heads of government or heads of state would attend. This time, there were fewer of them and more people with specific portfolios to do with trade or investment. And I guess that is also reflective of how host states or potential host states partners are looking at the future of the Belt and Road, that it's not this sort of big fanfare that you really have to devote all your political resources and capital and your top officials to. It's more of a sort of working level, steady, sort of practical kind of a thing now. So I think those are the takeaways I'd draw from the Third Belt and Road Forum.
Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Chong. This has been a very insightful conversation. So thank you.
You're very welcome.
Once again, that was Dr. Chong Jia-ian, who joined us for a discussion on the Belt and Road Initiative. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at @beyond_headlines, checking out our website, www.beyondtheheadlines.net, or by following us on Instagram at @beyondtheheadlines. This week, our host radio station is launching their fall fundraising drive. Beyond the Headlines is incredibly lucky for the opportunity to air on CIUT every Monday, but we need your support to continue providing you with policy-oriented content. Help us reach the goal of 100,000 by donating online at www.ciut.fm from November 13th to 19th. Our next guest, Dr. Isaac Odum, is an assistant professor of political science at Carleton University. He is also a non-resident fellow at the Center for Asian Studies at the University of Ghana, Accra, and was a visiting researcher at the Institute of West Asian and African Studies in Beijing. Dr. Odum's research primarily focuses on African politics, Africa-China relations, and the political economy of development in the Global South. His work has been published in leading journals, such as the Journal of Asian and African Studies and the African Review of Economics and Finance.
Welcome, Dr. Odum. Thank you so much for joining me today on Beyond the Headlines.
Thank you for having me today.
So to start our conversation, could you provide our listeners with some background of the Belt and Road Initiative in Africa? So why did China include African nations in the BRI, and what strategic considerations were behind this decision?
So, Ragini, let me answer that question by first saying that cooperation between China and its African counterpart were already dominated by the key issues in the BRI, so trade, investment, and connectivity enhancing infrastructure project. This were happening prior to the beginning of the BRI formalization in terms of the signing of memorandum of understanding between Africa and China. Someone has called it that in the context of the Africa-China relations, the BRI is similar to a child who is named 2 years after they were born, because it was already ongoing. I mean, a lot of the investment and infrastructure and trade was already happening between China and its African counterpart. I mean, after the adoption of the BRI in China, Chinese-backed infrastructure project, whether it is in railway or roads or power plant or port and what have you, really saw a significant increase across the continent. But China's inclusion of African countries in the Belt and Road can be attributed to several key factors and also even strategic considerations. So if you look at the countries, for example, naturally, because of the location of countries such as Kenya, Tanzania, Somalia, because these are countries that are on the shores of the Indian Ocean. And of course, Egypt and Djibouti, and those are on the Mediterranean Ocean. These are strategic locations that make them natural partners of the BRI, because they link Africa to Europe and they link Africa to Asia. So there's a geopolitical influence that China sought to pursue with the inclusion of African countries. So by engaging African countries through the BRI, China aimed to strengthen its diplomatic and political influence in the region. And China, in my view, saw this as a way to secure support on the international stage and to gain access to African vote in forums like the United Nations. So if you remember, if you go back into the 1970s, it was the African vote at the UN that helped to secure and restore the People's Republic of China's seat at the UN. And Africa, of course, made up of 54 countries. Their voting bloc at the United Nations General Assembly is a big deal. So every country, including China, is interested in striking a relationship with them, right? So geopolitical influence. The second one I would mention is that China is also sought to expand its market, and Africa is a place to go. So China sought to tap into the African market, which offers a very substantial opportunity for Chinese companies to sell their goods and services. Most people would know that the African continent is really rapidly growing population, right? There's a huge population growth, and there's an emerging class that really present the opportunity for Chinese product. Okay, so then African countries become an important sort of place for the BRI. The other one that we can also talk about is resource, access to resource. So Africa is rich in natural resources, in minerals, in oil, in agricultural product. And as we know, China's growing economy, it needs resources. And of course, Africa becomes an attractive destination for investment and cooperation. So you can see all of those things happening, why China will be interested in having African countries sign on to that. Of course, China also is interested in economic diplomacy. So the BRI is, I would argue, is part of China's broader strategy of economic diplomacy by providing loans and investment, that as it's been doing for infrastructure across Africa. China is able to strengthen its economic ties with African nations, thereby, of course, securing access to resources and market across Africa. So Africa countries' inclusion in the BRI is largely driven by China's aim to, its economic, diplomatic and political goals in the region. But of course, it's not only China that is interested in bringing Africans on board. The Africans themselves were interested in coming on board. And that's something that we can discuss as well.
Thank you, Dr. Udom. And you touched on this a little bit about how China is using the BRI for its economic diplomacy. Could you speak a bit more about how China has used the BRI as a tool of its foreign policies?
Well, since the launch of the Belt and Road Initiative in 2013, what we have seen is that across Africa and elsewhere, China has leveraged it as a significant tool of its foreign policy. And my view is that, for example, in the area of economic partnership, so what China has done is to use the BRI to establish economic partnerships with African nations. And it's done so through infrastructure development, it's done so through trade agreement, and it's done so through investment. And as a result of that, China has deepened its economic cooperation and positioned itself as a key trading partner. Of course, China surpassed the United States to become Africa's largest trading partner in 2009, way before the BRI was formally introduced. But as I mentioned before, the expansion of China's interest, and here I'm talking about the Chinese government and Chinese companies and Chinese state-owned enterprises, their involvement across Africa has increased over the years. And that has been a strategic tool that the Chinese have used over the years. But it's another dimension of this where China seeks to highlight this idea of South-South cooperation. So in China's engagement with African countries through the Belt and Road Initiative, China seeks to emphasize the principles of South-South cooperation and that China positions itself as a partner that respects the sovereignty and that engages in non-interference in the internal affairs of African countries. So this is an image that China wants to send across out there, that it does not interfere in the affairs of in the internal affairs of it, the countries that it engages with. The interesting thing is that this framework or this approach contrasts with the traditional Western aid and development models that African countries have engaged with the Western countries over the years. So the Chinese use this rhetoric of non-interference in domestic affairs, sovereignty, respect for sovereignty, whereas the many years of Africa's engagement with the Western world has been largely influenced by discourses around loss of sovereignty and imposition of economic models, different ways of life. And the Chinese have sought to sort of differentiate themselves by using this rhetoric of mutual respect, lack of conditionality, even though we know that it's not exactly the case. But this language, this narrative of Africa being a partner with the African countries appeals to the African elite and African policymakers because they like that. In my own work, in my interviews with African elite and African policymakers, they are attracted to China based on some of this rhetoric that it uses. The other dimension that I want to mention briefly is that in the area of cultural exchange. So if you go back 20, 15 years back, there were only a handful of Confucius Institute across Africa. Today, there are over 40 of them. And so cultural exchange program, academic partnerships, people-to-people engagement within the BRI has really been promoted. And we are seeing this happening across Africa. I was in Ghana this summer, and I visited the Confucius Institute at the University of Ghana in Accra. And I had a very fruitful conversation with the leadership over there at the Confucius Institute. One of the things that I learned is that, of course, there is a Confucius Institute also in Kumasi, which is the second largest city in Ghana. And guess what? There is another Confucius Institute being built at the University of Cape Coast. This is one way that China is projecting itself across Africa beyond the elite state-to-state relationship. This is people-to-people. And this is a significant tool, in my view, that China has used to leverage on its foreign policy across Africa.
So you did mention the perspective of African nations as to why they wanted to join the BRI. So could you speak a bit more about that?
I should say that African perspectives on the BRI are not uniform. Different countries have different priorities and expectations. And of course, the success or otherwise of the BRI across Africa in meeting the goals that African countries have set for themselves varies based on several factors, including governance, right, including transparency, and even the project, the terms of engagement in the specific project. South Africa was the first country to sign on the BRI in 2015. As of 2022, we have more than 40 African countries have signed on to the BRI, or some sort of they've signed some sort of memorandum of understanding on the BRI. In fact, the African Union has also signed a memorandum of understanding on the BRI with China. But there are some common goals and that we can talk about. So the first one is on infrastructure development. Many African countries have a significant infrastructure deficit, and this hinders economic development. And the primary infrastructure problem for the continent are mostly in the areas of energy, water, sanitation, telecom, and transportation. It would interest people to know that about 30 countries across Africa face some sort of power outages. Only slightly more than a third of Africans have access to electricity. So that tells you that it's a huge infrastructure deficit. In fact, the African Development Bank estimate that by 2025, the African continent will need to spend up to about $70 billion a year to upgrade its infrastructure. And so for Africa to experience economic success and economic growth, the infrastructure gap has to be filled. And so we see a substantial convergence between, Africa's infrastructure gap and how this needs to be financed. We see a convergence between that and China's outlook to invest what you can call surplus financial capital across Africa. Africa needs infrastructure. China is willing to provide funding and resources for this infrastructure project. So for most African countries, their hope is that the BRI investment in roads, in railways, in port, and in energy facilities will help to bridge this gap by improving transportation and connectivity within and between nations. There's another dimension to this. The African Union, which is the continental-wide union that oversees African affairs, has been talking about Agenda 2063. So Agenda 2063 is a strategic sort of framework where in the next 50 years, the African Union is trying to build a connected Africa. And this is only going to happen when there is that connectivity. And that connectivity happens when there's free movement of goods and services across borders. But if you don't have the transportation corridors that provides that's not going to happen. Africa also has the ambition. It's a very ambitious plan to have a common and a single market through the African continental free trade area. But these initiatives are only possible if there is infrastructure base, whether it's a telecommunication or road, to make that possible. And according to some of the current research coming out from the Center for Global Development in the US, China's two major foreign banks invested over $23 billion in infrastructure projects on the continent between 2007 and 2020. In context, that amount is about $8 billion more than the combined contributions of the other top eight lenders, which include the World Bank, or the African Development Bank, and the US and European Development Banks. So the Chinese have been very interested in investing in infrastructure across Africa. This is not to say that all of that is good, because there's several problems related to Chinese investment, which includes debt sustainability issues and transparency issues, and also even the quality of the infrastructure. So these are some of the main reasons why Africans have been very interested in the BRI. The other one that I want to mention briefly is the issue of diversification of partnership, right? Where African countries are seeking to diversify their diplomatic and economic partnerships. So by engaging with China through the BRI, what they've sought to do is to reduce their dependence on the traditional Western donors and to establish relationships with a broader range of international actors. And it's not just the Chinese. Brazil, Japan, even Russia, Turkey, Iran. I mean, Africa is increasing their engagement with these countries.
So over the last decade of the BRI, has there been any significant impact in terms of infrastructure on the African continent? And has there been, conversely, any domestic backlash in countries over these BRI projects?
Yes. I mean, the impact of the BRI across Africa, like I said, is not even. It depends on which country, so even it depends on which sector. So it's had both positive and controversial impact, varying by country by country, but also project by project. So let's just take railway, because that's one area that is huge infrastructure area. Specifically speaking, you can talk about projects such as the from Mombasa to Nairobi. This is the standard gauge railway. This is a $3.2 billion railway project in Kenya. It was very controversial in several areas because the terms of the loan and allegations of corruption in the project itself generated a lot of political debate and controversies. However, we know that this railway project has had very significant economic impact. So the SGR, the Standard Gauge Railway, has improved transportation connectivity between Kenya's two largest cities, Mombasa and Nairobi. It has reduced travel time. Research shows that it's lowered transportation cost and enhanced the movement of goods and people, contributing to economic growth in Kenya. Another big one is the project in Ethiopia from Addis Ababa to Djibouti, railway project. Over $4 billion. And of course, like I mentioned here, there were concerns, or there have been concerns about debt sustainability. And in fact, the Ethiopian government had to renegotiate the terms of the loan with the Chinese lenders on this project. However, this railway project has been beneficial in terms of enhancing Ethiopia's access to the port of Djibouti, which is a critical gateway for Ethiopian trade. This is also in the Horn of Africa. This is also facilitating regional integration. It is connecting Ethiopia to the sea and of course, contributing to economic development. The other one that a lot of people talk about is in Nigeria, from Lagos to Ibadan railway project. Here, again, there are concerns about the level of Nigeria's indebtedness to China as a result of this project, and the terms of engagement that led to the huge debate across Nigeria. But the modernization of this railway project, of course, improves transportation, and it is expected to contribute to economic growth, job creation, increase economic activity along the railway sector. So these are all specific interventions that we have seen across Africa. Talking about railways, I should mention that in all the railway projects that I just mentioned, were funded to various degrees, up to as much as 90% in the case of Kenya, for example, by the Export-Import Bank of China. And the contractors were also Chinese state-owned enterprises, such as the China Railway Construction Company. So you can see that the contract, the insurers, the creditors are all Chinese companies. And these are always issues of contention, right? Because if the construction and all of these things, and sometimes even labor issues, are all, these are all done by Chinese companies, how is that going to lead to Africa's development in terms of our local industry? To what extent is there technology transfer or knowledge transfer to the African space? That this is where you can see the protest and the backlash. And on some of these projects, we have had issues, for example, of labor issues, where the Chinese managers have had minimal respect for Africa's labor laws and labor rights of the people that are engaged in this project, the workers. And so these are areas or issues that bring about protest and resistance from civil society groups and ordinary citizens. In most of the cases, at the elite level, there is not much of a contention because they have signed the deals already. The other area is in environmental sustainability. The construction of dams and ports and what have you have had serious impact on the environment. In my own research, one of the things that I've seen is that there were projects in Ghana where the Bui Dam, this became functional before the formalization of BRI. But one of the things we have seen is that the environmental assessment feasibility study by the World Bank suggested that it was not a good thing to do. And so the World Bank did not fund this project. And then the Ghanaian government went to the Chinese, and the Chinese funded this project and constructed it. Of course, it's a huge benefit to Ghana because Ghana was facing serious electricity problems. And so this dam comes in to solve that problem, or at least to contribute to solving that problem.
Now, you've touched a bit about debt sustainability. We know that China is the largest bilateral creditor for many African nations, including Zambia, which defaulted in 2020. And there are concerns of more countries in the region slipping into debt distress. So what is the role of BRI been in this looming debt crisis?
That's one of the biggest issues that I think everybody should be paying attention. So the BRI has had or played a significant role in the growing debt concerns in some African countries. This has contributed to some of the call out there or some of the debate about the looming debt crisis across Africa. So number one, Chinese loans and financing from under the BRI project have been a major source of external debt for many African countries, because these loans have been used to fund large-scale infrastructure projects, which have been very expensive. As a result, a lot of African countries have accumulated substantial debt to Chinese lenders. One of the biggest problems with Chinese lending is that some of the BRI terms of the loans lack transparency. So when it comes to the Chinese financing of African countries, China does not publish the details of its loan on open sources. Official data on Chinese loans are not publicly available. And so almost all the numbers that are circulated that we see around are mostly estimations or approximations, because China is not a member of the OECD countries. And so it does not take part in the organization's creditor reporting system. So this lack of transparency has made it challenging for host countries and their citizens and even international observers to fully understand the terms and conditions and also the implications of these loans. And this contributes to the debt sustainability discussions. This has also amplified the accusations that are coming from some people in Africa, but also from Western sources, that China is engaging in debt trap across Africa, and that is trapping them into debt. And that once, for example, Africans are unable to pay it, then Beijing can take control of vital state asset. Let me say that in Africa, there is no credible evidence that suggests that China has taken control of any state-owned asset in any African country because that African country wasn't able to pay its obligation to China. That needs to be made clear. The Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, they have a huge database of Chinese lending across Africa, and they have over 1,000 loans. And we have not seen any example where we would say that the Chinese have somewhat deliberately entangled an African country in debt and then they have used that to seize assets. So that hasn't happened maybe yet. But the other thing I also want to say is that majority of African countries that have received finance from China have had a history of debt distress over the years. They've gone to the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, prior to the rise of China as a net capital exporter to Africa. And the other thing is that China is not the largest holder of Africa's external debt. So this is important. Of course, China is Africa's largest bilateral creditor. However, China holds about 21% of Africa's debt. The remaining external debt is owed to other external private sector financiers and multilateral financial institutions, including, of course, domestic creditors. The amount of debt that Africans owe to China is less when it's compared to multilateral and other private lenders. However, of course, the percentage of the debt owed to China differ on country by country level. So that's always important to clarify. Let's take Ghana, for example, and we can also talk about Zambia. Let's take Ghana, for example. Ghana in 2022 defaulted on its loan. Ghana owes about $30 billion in external debt, and it has gone, had had to go to the IMF to get a bailout. The composition of this $13 billion, if you look at it, Ghana owes to China just about $2 billion. The Paris Club is about $2 billion, and then others, including domestic creditors, $3.8 billion. And then when you look at the multilateral banks, $8.8 billion. The big chunk of this, about $13 billion, is in Eurobonds. So yes, in terms of bilateral creditor, in the case of Ghana, for example, and in other countries like Ethiopia and Zambia, China is the largest bilateral creditor. But we always have to put this in context because Africa owes more debt to other actors and other institutions more than China. The other one that I would mention quickly is that unlike other loans that African countries owe to external creditors, a lot of the loans that are owed or some of the loans that are owed to China is because they are asset-backed loans. In some cases, BRI-related loans have been structured as resource-backed loans where the asset that are developed with the loan serve as a collateral. So I have done work in Ghana on how Ghana uses proceeds from cocoa beans and oil to pay its debt. So if a country fails to pay the loans, there can be that risk. That's why people talk about debt trap, that there can be a risk that China may confiscate the natural resource or have access to it in order to cover the debt that is owed, right? But like I said, we haven't seen credible examples, evidence of that across Africa. So the debt issue is a big one, and China knows that it's a big issue. It's really contributed to why the BRI expenditure on the China side has really lowered in recent times.
So given this high level of debt distress, as well as China's slowing domestic economic growth, mm-hmm. do you see the BRI and even more broadly Africa-China relations evolving in the coming years?
We are already seeing what I call a recalibrating of the Africa-China relationship. And we are seeing this as a result of what is going on domestically across African countries in terms of the debt sustainability discussions. But it's also the recalibration is also happening because of the domestic issues in China in terms of the slow economic growth that we are seeing in China. And of course, since 2020, we have seen that Chinese lending across Africa under the BRI has really significantly dropped. In fact, there is no longer any serious infrastructure project in, say, energy, for example. And so now what we are seeing is a smaller project. Small is beautiful. The discussion about small is beautiful. So smaller project with lower financial risk may gain more attention or is beginning to gain more attention. And this project may be more manageable for host countries and for China. So we are seeing some changes. Some people are talking about BRI 2.0, although now it looks more like 3.0 with the recent the anniversary forum that was held in Beijing. So, I mean, generally, there's going to be greater scrutiny and risk assessment on the part of China when it comes to BRI, because the debt sustainability and transparency, as those conversations continue to grow, both China and the African recipient would have to reassess that. So that we are seeing that is happening. We're also seeing debt restructuring and negotiations. I mentioned the Ethiopian case, but it's happening in Zambia, it's happening in Ghana. The other thing that we have seen, especially coming from the last week's anniversary forum in Beijing, is that China is going to open its market to African economies a bit much more than it used to do in several areas. So that's a positive progress, if you will. The other thing that we're also seeing is that there is a bit more emphasis now on transition to green energy project across Africa. So China is at the forefront of the green transition across Africa. So investment in solar energy, investment in renewable energy resources across Africa, but still under the BRI. But the other important part that I think is critical is the question of African agency in all of these discussions about the impact of the BRI going forward. Increasingly, my hope and expectation is that African countries become more assertive in shaping the terms of their engagement with China under the BRI and seeking greater agency in project selection, in negotiation and implementation of this project. Because one of the things that we have seen is that China's increasing focus on Africa within the BRI is actually drawing in the Europeans and the Americans into Africa, the infrastructure sector, than they had done in the past. The Americans are talking about, it started under Trump talking about Prosperity Africa Project, and then Biden is talking about the Build Better World. And then, of course, the European Union is talking about Gateway Project, which is basically seeking to bridge the infrastructure gap in low-income countries, including Africa. So the evolution of the BRI, in my view, in the coming years, is likely to be shaped by complex factors. So economic, political and environmental factors, both in China and on the African side, but also external to both China and Africa, like what we are seeing with the Europeans and the Americans.
Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. Thank you so much for your insights and for joining us, Dr. Odum.
Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, that was Dr. Isaac Odum, who joined us for a discussion on the Belt and Road Initiative in Africa. This week, our host radio station is launching their fall fundraising drive. For 36 years, CIUT has been the sound of Toronto's community radio. Beyond the Headlines is incredibly lucky for the opportunity to air on CIUT every Monday, but we need your support to continue providing you with policy-oriented content. Donate online from November 13 at www.ciutfm and help us reach the goal of 100,000. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Dr. Chongjia Ian and Dr. Isaac Odum. Many thanks to them for coming on to the show to discuss 10 years of China's Belt and Road Initiative. Today's show was produced by myself, Ragini Singhavar. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you're listening. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Hmong School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada, follow us on Twitter at beyond_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram.